Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for the 37th episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is Digging In, Coal Barons, Injustice, and Resistance. I'm joined by Chris Hamby. He is the author of Soul Full of Coal Dust, A Fight for Breath and Justice in Appalachia. The publisher is Little Brown & Company. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, absolutely. So tell me a bit about the book, and then I'm going to go back and say more about your credentials.
Yeah, well, so this book really grew out of some reporting that I did while I was a cub reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, which is a nonprofit investigative news outlet based in Washington, D.C., where I live. And I had looked into I started looking at black lung back in 2011, and I realized there was this larger story that I wanted to tell even after basically doing a couple of years of extensive reporting and work and released multiple stories. But there really was a larger narrative of two men really and their fight for justice and how that reflected all of the ways that black lung remains a problem in this country, which I think is surprising for a lot of people, and how we have not delivered on the two promises that we made to this nation's miners in 1969 when we passed landmark legislation that promised to eventually virtually eradicate this disease and in the meantime provide fair compensation to those stricken by it. And we have not delivered on either of those promises. And so this book is really a larger narrative driven by two men's fight to make those promises a reality.
Yeah, no, it's a scandal that black lung disease has not been taken care of. This particularly interesting topic to me, my grandfather on my mom's side was a miner at parts of his career, both in a tin mine in Butte, Montana, and trying to survive the Great Depression by blasting lignite coal out of a coulee vein in North Dakota to get by. Wow. So it comes home as a topic. Let me just go back over Chris's credentials a little bit before we plunge in further. He is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He's won the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting in 2014. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in international reporting in 2017. Topics he's interested in covering include labor, public health, the environment, criminal justice, politics, and international trade. He's a native of Nashville, Tennessee. Let's go back to your background, actually. I'm curious how it is that you found yourself interested in being a reporter, and in particular, an investigative reporter. What was the motivation, the aha moment that led you this direction?
Yeah, I always had been interested in writing, and I really came to journalism through a love of writing. But I went back to a high school internship when I interned at the local paper writing about sports and, write what you know. And that was what I knew at the time as a 17, 18-year-old kid.
Sure.
So that's how I got into it. And it just kind of took off from there. And then as I did more reporting, I mean, I did the usual, covering beats, police, courts, politics, all those sorts of things. And I loved it, but I also know that sort of my predilections and interests are sort of gravitate more towards long-term projects and really digging into deep policy issues. And so I ended up getting more into that and went to grad school to get a master's in investigative reporting from the University of Missouri, and then started out with as a very young intern and then got hired on at the Center for Public Integrity, as I mentioned, in Washington, D.C., which is great. So I got the opportunity to start doing basically being second or third chair on projects related to environmental and public health and labor issues.
Sure. Well, you know, the title of our episode is Digging In. And of course, there's the coal barons and running coal, and there's the people who dug in to fight against the injustices. But of course, you dug in as well into this topic and stayed with this topic. What was it about Appalachia that, you know, I think at some point here, you know, it's a wonderful book. You've done really well in your career. There must have been something here where it really began to seize your heartstrings and your imagination. What can you give us about this region that really is evocative for you?
Yeah, that was the thing that, you know, when you do a book, you really have to love the subject matter or else it starts to feel, there are times throughout the process when it starts to feel tedious or like it will never end. But it was easy to stay motivated with this one because of, as you mentioned, the sort of, there's this magnetism to this area of Appalachia. And I specifically spent a lot of time in central Appalachia, largely southern West Virginia. And also to the people who live there, and it was amazing just from early on in the process from the beginning. I mean, I had a sense that there was a good story there too, and that there were facts to be uncovered. But it was also just spending time going to southern West Virginia and to eastern Kentucky and southwestern Virginia, where we're seeing this real upsurge in recent years, in the past probably about 15 years, of severe black lung disease after years of decline. And just sitting with miners in their living rooms, and they welcomed me into their homes and just kind of shooting the breeze, talking about mining, learning about all the things that went on underground and how remarkable it is and how smart a lot of these people are, you know, really, I think we tend to discount people who live in rural Appalachia. They have their own very particular, you know, expertise and are very intelligent and thoughtful people in a lot of ways, I found, and were very welcoming to me. And it was just a real joy to talk with them. And it also, of course, just when you're sitting in a living room with someone who otherwise looks relatively healthy and is in his 40s or 50s, and after about 15 to 20 minutes of conversation is struggling to breathe, is literally gasping and making these horrible sounds that I'll never forget. You would never forget this once you hear it. It's hard to look away from that. And then when you start to realize that it's unnecessary for them to suffer from that, and that there are things we could do to be alleviating that suffering, but that isn't happening, it is very easy to stay motivated, I will say.
So there's a couple of things you brought up there that I really was interested in pursuing. One is, I mean, you come in as an outsider. I think if I remember right from the book, you mentioned being middle class and from Nashville. And you don't have any ties to the region that I know of, but you know, your caring, your respect for these people, obviously your ability to bond with them comes through very nicely in the book. How did that dynamic work? I mean, was there some initial resistance, suspicion on their part, just because you were interested in the cause that carried the day? What was it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, because on top of that, it did help some that I'm from Tennessee and grew up in Tennessee. But, you know, I was this reporter coming in from Washington, D.C., you know, writing about national news. And, you know, I think there is sort of a natural skepticism. And also, you know, for good reason, a lot of these, especially miners who are still working, are reluctant to speak publicly to reporters because, they depend so heavily on, you know, this is really one of the best and only really good paying jobs with good benefits in the area for a lot of people. And companies really have kind of inculcated this fear of any criticism will, you know, you could get fired for that. So add that to the fact that I was kind of coming in as an outsider, but I just really tried to not make assumptions, to, you know, try and talk as little as possible and listen more. That's what we always do with as reporters. We try to do that, but just to not prejudge people, have empathy, and just ask open-ended questions and let them talk. But there were, you know, there were times when, my initial reporting down there, I went down with some reporters from NPR, great Howard Berkus, and the producer Sandra Bartlett, and we would just kind of go where the government had set up these this RV basically that was going around coal country, doing basically breath tests and X-rays on miners to try and get a sense of this resurgence and how it was going, and we would just sit at these clinics and just hang out with guys as they would go through this testing process. And I remember in particular there was one that was set up at a fire station in Whitesville, West Virginia, and I was talking with some guys outside the RV, and they said, you probably think we're all, we're all a bunch of rednecks down here, ignorant rednecks. And I said, well, you probably think all the people from all of us coming down from DC are a bunch of stuck up, jerks. And we just kind of laughed, and, it kind of broke the ice, and we just got to talking. But, it's really easy to just talk with these guys and say, tell me about the mines, and they'll just go, and it's fascinating. And so it was just a joy to really to get to know them and to do this reporting.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, no, those preconceptions can be interesting. I remember, reporters come into Iowa, my neighboring state, to Minnesota, every time the Iowa caucuses are going to happen, and they say, well, we expect them to be Bartles and James, but they actually talk like McNeil and Lair back in the old days, quite informed voters. So, yes, it's never good to presume, and you didn't presume that people aren't up to snuff or can't hold a good conversation or worthwhile to have that conversation with. A couple of times now you've made reference to the upsurge of black lung. So what's the story behind that upsurge? What's going on here after all?
Yeah, it's fascinating. That's actually what originally drew me to black lung in the first place, because, black lung doesn't seem like an obvious thing to be reporting on when I started this in 2011. And it was when we actually got a report of the Upper Big Branch mine disaster. There was one page in there that was kind of a sidebar that said, it noted that of the 29 miners who were killed, 24 had enough lung tissue to be looked at on an autopsy. And of those, 17 had signs of black lung, and they were, young guys who hadn't been in the mines for that long. And then it sort of noted as an aside that this was consistent with what government researchers had been documenting for a few years, this uptick in disease. So really, that was very surprising to me that was happening. And basically in the early 1970s, we put into place rules that required companies to control the amount of dust in the mines with the idea that that would eventually eradicate the disease. And then in the meantime, we would provide fair compensation to those who continued to be exposed to high levels and get the disease. And that really didn't happen. And I think there are a few pretty strong theories on reasons why. And one is that the system that was set up to monitor this disease is largely a self-policing system where companies monitor themselves. Some of that is by necessity because arguably you could never have enough inspectors to go take these samples of dust levels at mines consistently enough to, you know, to actually have a good idea. But there are all sorts of ways that companies have both exploited loopholes in the system, and as I found in my reporting, just there's been evidence of rampant fraud for decades, and efforts to crack down on that have really not been very effective. So there's the fact that, you know, even though the levels reported to the government look like companies are complying with the law, they're actually not in a lot of cases. And then you add to that sort of more recently the economics of the mining industry, really, where you have miners working longer hours and you're working in thinner seams. So if you think of coal seams as like layers in a layer cake, a lot of the really nice thick seams were mined out years ago. And so you're left with the thinner ones. And for years, it didn't make sense economically to go after those. But now with the advent of both, you sort of have a confluence of more powerful machines. And when the market conditions are right, especially with steelmaking metallurgical coal, that it makes sense to go after these thin seams of coal, but that necessarily means cutting a lot of rock above and below the seams and sometimes within the seam. And that unleashes a more toxic mixture of dust that contains more silica. And there's good evidence that this is showing up in miners' lungs, causing more severe disease. So I think that's probably the other leading factor here, and just one sort of forward-looking point on that. The government has been considering a regulation to impose a more stringent specific standard on silica, this mineral that is causing this more severe disease, but that has sort of stalled under the Trump administration, and there is now a lot of pressure on the incoming Biden administration to perhaps revisit and even implement such a rule that might protect miners.
Okay. This is a very people-centric book, and rightly so. So I wanted to go to a couple of them that were really central to your story. Gary Fox and John Klein. Can you both describe, you know, the role they play in the book? But I'm also looking for a sense of who they are and, you know, their personality, their motivations, you know, so we can get a real read on them.
Yeah. So Gary Fox is, he was a coal miner born in an old coal camp in southern West Virginia. And his father was a miner. He was one of a few boys raised pretty much by his mother, because his father died when he was very young. Grew up in basically across from a coal tipple, where everything was, you know, the whole town was black, coated with black coal dust. And Gary he was very focused on, you know, basically lifting his family, starting a family and lifting them out of the poverty that he'd grown up in. And that led him to go into the coal mines in the early 1970s. And he worked his entire career during what should have been, you know, after what should have been the rules that virtually eradicated the disease. So people like Gary should not have become ill, yeah. But he did. And then his story ultimately intersects with that of John Klein. And John Klein was sort of an idealistic volunteer in the war on poverty from upstate New York, who came to the West Virginia coal fields in the late 1960s as a community organizer and ended up staying, becoming a carpenter, running a business that built homes almost exclusively for people of modest means who qualified for a low-interest government loan program. And then he started working as a benefits counselor at this rural medical clinic that received federal funds to diagnose and treat miners who had black lung. And his job was basically to help them file initial claims, not necessarily to represent them. And not many people would represent miners because there are all sorts of disincentives for lawyers to take these cases. But John, for some reason, and a lot of people thought he was a little bit crazy for doing this, but he started representing miners as a lay representative while he was working at this clinic. And it was there that he started to unravel what he believed was a systematic scheme by the leading law firm retained by most large coal companies.
You mean Jackson Kelly?
The one exactly.
That, okay.
Yes. And so that is eventually led him to Gary Fox, who was fighting Jackson Kelly in his ongoing claim.
Sure. Well, I think they're both unique people. One thing is, you know, Gary Fox isn't just a miner. He's a very specialized miner. It's called a roof bolter. What is a roof bolter?
Yeah, these are the people who do one of the most dangerous jobs and also one of the most high exposure to dust jobs in the mines. And so after the machine, usually most sections where Gary worked, it was a continuous mining machine. So this is basically, think of a rotating drum head studded with carbide tipped teeth sort of chewing through this coal seam and carving out a room about 20 by 20 and maybe about 6 feet high, depending on how high the coal seam was. And so you've got, it's inherently unstable. And so roof bolters like Gary would go in with a machine and they would drive these metal roofs into metal bolts in through the roof to pin layers of rock together to hopefully render a cave-in less likely. And it was, you know, as I mentioned, one of the most dangerous things you could do in the mines.
Yeah, no. So these are both very capable people because, you know, John Klein, if I remember right from the book, you know, really brings himself into law practices, isn't where he started. And it takes a lot of stamina to go through all those medical notices and engage in this kind of, you know, convoluted fight. Let's move over to the villains because this book does have some villains. I'm particularly interested in two or three of them. One is Paul Wheeler from, of all places, Johns Hopkins, which was not what I expected to be the location for one of the villains. And then there's Don Blankenship. So maybe can you talk about both of them and what kind of characters we're talking about?
It's interesting. Yeah, that was what surprised me was to, when I was going through all these cases to see where coal companies were, you know, they're allowed to contest these. And so they get their own doctors to read the x-rays, and they almost always said that the miner didn't have black lung. But what was surprising was that it was coming from Johns Hopkins, and most of them, in fact, from this one doctor who led this unit of radiologists, Paul Wheeler, as you mentioned. And he was exceptionally well-credentialed and had sort of the institutional weight of Hopkins behind him and was able to really have an outsized impact on a large number of cases. I mean, we're talking thousands of cases over 40 years. And it was interesting to, you know, I tried to explore in the book some of his potential motivations because he wouldn't really speak at length with me, but he does have he does have an extensive record that I pieced together sort of laboriously over time. And it's interesting, you know, he kind of has a mix of, you know, they were receiving a lot more money for their readings than
yep.
other doctors would. But it's not clear how much of that went directly to him. And then he also seemed to have just sort of an ideological aversion to, basically, he suspected that miners, that disease shouldn't be showing up still, over the last 20 years, and that miners who were purporting to have disease were trying to put one over and get a handout, essentially, is what a lot of his statements amounted to. He was certainly an interesting character who's pervasive throughout the book. And then Don Blankenship is, I think a lot of people will know him as the sort of cantankerous CEO of Massey Energy, which is no longer in existence, but it's sort of their record of environmental and safety violations culminated in the Upper Big Branch mine disaster. And Gary Fox, the principal character in my book, worked for him at a Massey mine. And interestingly, a lot of the practices that increased the risk for things like explosions and cave-ins and other sorts of accidents also caused a lot more dust to be unleashed. And so it was really, I talked with a number of Gary's coworkers, and the dusty conditions really appear to have led to a lot of cases of severe black lung, such as what Gary experienced.
Now, is Blankenship, unusually, I guess, rapacious? I mean, you mentioned that he's smart, relentless, and meticulous, is how you described him in the book. Is he a cut different than other coal barons? Is there something particular that's driving him? I'm curious from a character study point of view.
Yeah, it's interesting because he, depending on who you ask, he's either an outlier or sort of just sort of an exaggerated personality who sort of takes on the, it's sort of like the worst impulses of the coal industry writ large in a lot of people's views, in that he at a time when a lot of people were not investing in Southern West Virginia, Central Appalachia, he doubled down. And he really does seem to have this view. He's very much, he has a website now, and he's since, run for political office. He calls himself an American competitionist. He very much believes in the free market. He was fiercely anti-union, fiercely anti-environmental regulations, and he really just felt that, he seemed to promote this idea of basically America as a meritocracy and pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, and the strongest would survive, and that was why his company was doing so well, and it did, it was very successful until things all collapsed after the Upper Big Branch mine disaster.
Sure. So you mentioned in the book that there is a tradition of fatalism in Appalachia. This is, as you said, another place, a place steeped in beauty and blood. For John Klein, coming in from the outside, is that what maybe helped him escape the fatalism and fight as he did on behalf of Gary Fox and others? What do you see? Where's this region going? You mentioned the Biden administration coming in, but do we have some causes for hope in all of this? And will the people fight, or is the fear of big coal, King Coal, just too strong?
Well, that's the fascinating thing about this region, is that there is a sense of fatalism, but there is also this sense of indefatigable optimism. And it's an interesting mix, and you've always, throughout the history, really going back from the 60s through the present, you have people who, not only do you have people in the region who are standing up and fighting, but you also have these people who come from places like New York and California, or, Pennsylvania and elsewhere, and they're coming in, and they really have they become strong advocates. They sort of, much in the same way that I became captivated by the region, they became captivated by it, by the people, by the injustices that have been so predominant throughout the history of this region and that still persist today. And I think it's really been a combination of determined outsiders who are largely idealistic sort of left-leaning folks and then, you know, some very determined Appalachian residents who have sort of, you know, been this core coalition that for, you know, the past 50 years has really been fighting to make the 1969 law, the promises of disease eradication and fair compensation realities. And they've really together achieved some remarkable reforms in recent years. And, you know, so the book is not all doom and gloom, though much of it is about injustice. There is quite a bit of hope at the end, which was actually very surprising and encouraging to me as a reporter, because it doesn't happen all that often. But in this case, when a lot of the injustices came to light, you know, this coalition pushed for reform and the government responded and enacted some meaningful changes that have really helped people.
No. And the book does indeed end on a high note. A muted or a careful high note, but that there is a sense of progress. And it's just remarkable to me how these people have stayed in this fight when it's a pretty uneven fight by and large. Is there any larger lessons that people can take from this story about, you know, other ways in which we can fight additional injustices, whether in Appalachia or beyond, things that proved effective in that fight that are a good template for the future?
I think the biggest lesson here is that there's a large element of luck to it, but there's also a large element of just persistence and determination. So as I mentioned, you know, this has been really a lot of the people in the book have been fighting for 30 years or more for some of these causes, and they just at many points were sort of banging their heads against the wall, they felt like, and they kept making the same point and not getting this kind of reception that they wanted. And then they had a setback where, you know, they almost got it across the finish line, but then it largely died at the last minute at the end of the Clinton administration. And then it was basically off the table for another 8 to 10 years, the kinds of reforms that they were looking for. But I think the lesson really is that when you have a combination of determined, even if it's just a small group of determined but persistent advocates who have who are focused and who have a strong message, at some point there will be a window of opportunity that arises. And if those people seize on that opportunity, they really can accomplish a lot. Now, that's rare, but it's also a good lesson for me, and one that made me sort of restored my faith a little bit in both people and in our system of government to some degree.
Well, that is good. I mean, to me, one thing is, you know, black lung just as a term is so evocative. It gives you that kind of rallying cry. I mean, the stakes are so high. How can you back off when it's people's lives that are literally, you know, on the line here? So, Chris, I want to thank you so much for having been a guest. This has been Chris Hamby. His book is called Soul Full of Coal Dust, A Fight for Breath and Justice in Appalachia. This is episode 37 of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. You can find more information about the episode by going to my blog posting at https://emotionswizard.com. If you've joined today's show, you can listen to it again. You can give a review on iTunes, a rating, all of that. If you want to know about other episodes, you can go to my company's website at the 3 W's, sensorylogic.com. Finally, I'd like to conclude every episode with an appropriate epigram. We've been talking about injustice today, so I'm going to cite Reinhold Niebuhr, who said, "Man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible, but man's inclination for injustice makes democracy necessary." Until next time, be kind and stay safe.